This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Some of the ideas. We talked about three dimensions of clothing. We talked about clothing as an expression for a protection of privacy. And so we talked about the importance of privacy in a society that doesn't always value privacy. The idea that our clothing, and you remember we defined clothing as everything the world sees. Right? Clothing is not about just your fashion items. Clothing is the way you act, the things you do, the expression on your face. Everything the world sees is clothing. And clothing is to protect the private property so that, well, for lots of reasons, but one of them is it leaves you free to play in your private property. Leaves you free to explore. Leaves you free to try things without getting constant feedback of expectations from people around you. People around you don't need to know what you're doing in your private property. People in the streets don't need to know what you're doing in your house. And people in your house don't need to know what you're doing in your bedroom. There are different levels of privacy, and the ability to close the door is an ability to feel freedom in a private place. And we don't do that often enough while we're functioning in the world. So this is not unlike some of the exercises we've done where we say, take 5 minutes of the day, take 10 minutes of the day, take a half an hour of the day. The privacy exercise is something we need to become conscious of doing simultaneously with everything else we do. So that we're living in a dual interface at all times. The public is seeing something of you, but at that very time, stuff is going on inside you and you're in touch with it. And you should get in touch with it. While you're busy doing stuff, this is not the multitasking. This is while you're doing stuff. Whether it's rebounding or you're working, you're walking down the street, you should be checking in on my private property right now. What's happening there? Is it neglected? Are the weeds sent up? Am I feeling certain things? Am I accessing certain things? Am I deepening certain intuitions? Just to be conscious. No judgment. And get angry with yourself if nothing's going on. But that's an interesting observation. Gee, quite interesting. Nothing's going on in the house. It's all in the garden. It's all outside. I'm living on the sidewalk. My house is empty. I've got this beautiful house and this beautiful garden, but I live on the sidewalk. Or I live in the yard. Or I live in my living room. What about the rest of the house? The rest of the house being used. Just to try and access some of the inner chambers. And the times you can do it is when you separate yourself, the times you can do it while you're meditating or gardening or sitting quietly outside or sitting on a bus in those places where people use buses or trains or planes. You don't have to be doing something else all the time. Sometimes there's a time to check in with your private property, and sometimes even while you're doing something else, you check in with your private property and it won't distract you. What distracts you is changing the tense. If you go into future tense or past tense, you get distracted from the present. But if you go deeper into the present than the surface, you don't distract anything at all. So while I'm speaking to David here, I'm thinking about a phone call I'm going to make when I'm finished speaking to him. That detracts from this interaction. And it will be a lesser interaction, as Sharon told us from her experience. But if while I'm speaking to David, I'm checking in with deeper stuff. What's going on? What am I feeling while I'm speaking to him? What's happening in my private property? What do I sense is happening in his private property? What is he telling me? What's behind it? Looking into the eyes. Eyes are the window that's all we talked about. Looking into the character ring. Look at my open eyes. If I interact more deeply, if I go down levels and levels and levels while I'm talking, I'm not changing the sense. I'm involved in the present. But I'm involved in the present on deeper and deeper levels. And we'll talk about the levels in a moment. The second dimension of clothing we talked about was the spelling of the word not all, garments of leather, as it was spelt in the Aramaic, the Torah, because it was spelled in the Arabic. Not all meaning garments of energy, garments of light. So the garments are not only protection from the outside, but they are also amplifiers, they also radiate our personality. We talked about radiating our majesty. And the truth is, the more majestic we are as individuals, the less we need the clothing. But bear in mind once more, totally means everything the world sees. So, if from the expression on my face and from my bearing, people can sense my majesty, then the clothes are not that evil. There's nothing particularly majestic about my facial expression and my bearing, and maybe the clothing is more important. But even the simplest human being has a divine majesty just by virtue of him or her being human that can be amplified through clothing. Once again, I can't overemphasize that clothing means everything the outside world can see. Every action, every gesture, every expression, as well as clothing and other props that we use to interface with the rest of the world. So not only does our external interface, just like our house, we put an exterior, we put a facade on the house. We don't only decorate the inside. Why do we decorate the outside? Why do we care what the outside looks like? It's not just all the neighbors will be upset because the neighbors will be scared, it's for something else too. The matter is the house external face radiates something about what's inside the house, about who the people are. You can walk past it down the neighborhood and look at the houses. The external tells you something about the people inside. As external as it is and as superficial as it is, something is radiated. And by the external image. So the image, the external image, is one of the things we use to radiate our sense of majesty. And we talked about the majesty of the human being, and particularly, even more so, the majesty of the Jewish soul. What's important when we differentiate between the majesty of the Jewish soul and the non-Jewish soul is, once again, it's not something exclusive and non-available to a non-Jew. Judaism is available to anybody who wants it, anybody who chooses it. What is unique about that, or what extends even further, is the vastness of our span. That we span the distance, so to say, from the force on God's throne, if you remember we said, not even just God's throne, from the force on God's throne. There's a part of us that touches that. Every individual, every Jew, there's a part of your soul that connects to the energy on God's throne, not God himself. God's one level above that. But there's an energy, there's an aura, there's a presence on the throne. Part of your soul connects there, and part of your soul connects to your body. And a palace includes everything in between. Every world, every universe of energy in between, that ultimate energy and our physical form down there is included by your own soul. So, although physically you think of yourself as a confined human being that only takes up a few square feet, conceptually and from an energy point of view, you're a being that spans universes. And your capacity to impact is universal. That's something we've got to tune into. And that's something that through our clothing, our bearing, our conduct, our expressions, our interactions, we are able to project them to the sanctuary. And then the third area, which they all link together, of course, the third area was the concept of levush, which is that these souls, if you take from that connection to the energy of God's throne, all the way down to our physical body, each form is an item of clothing. It clothes the one above it. So it's like a container within a container within a container within a container, and so millions of them. So on the very most external form, my suit of clothes might be the most external form, and then comes my skin, and then comes my internal organs, and then comes my soul. But the soul itself now goes through thousands or hundreds of thousands of different levels, each one contained in the other one. So it's not like a long chain of link. It's like one contained within the other, within the other, within the other. Now that's very, very significant, because what that means then is, if you can think of it that way, that we are a force of energy within another force, within another force, within another force, and so on there, then we begin to understand how physical movement impacts the spiritual, and vice versa. That through a spiritual movement, a gesture that I make, with that movement, I'm moving my soul too. With a physical movement, I'm moving my soul. And with the soul that is clothed by this body, I'm also moving the soul that soul clothes. And all the way through, down to the very essential point, which move means, I move something from that source of energy that sits on God's face, that controls the whole world. Every movement, every gesture has some kind of impact, and then it immediately comes back again. It reverberates back again in an amplified form and impacts the whole world, especially me. So it's a two-way, it's a two-way direction. We call that in the which are initiations, which are the initiations of movements or of the evoking of feelings and emotions from down here that impact above, and the reverberating one from above that impacts down here. So there's a constant flow of energy all the time, backwards and forwards. These sparks are flying. You can try and picture it. You're actually going to try and picture it. The fact that you can't see it is almost tragic. The reason we can't see it is because we would be paralyzed with fear. If we did understand the impact of what we're doing, we wouldn't do anything. We wouldn't move. We would just be too scared. And we've got to be able to try and conceive of the enormity of this flow of energy that's taking place all the time, that these sparks are flying backwards and forwards, and every thought, every feeling, every gesture within you impacts there. And the more spiritually attuned you are, and the more of a spiritually evolved and fine and godly attuned person you are, the more that impact is amplified. So it's not just that everybody has the same kind of impact. The extent of the forcefulness of that energy backwards and forwards depends on your spiritual energy, on how much spiritual energy you generate. That will determine that forcefulness. So that was some of the things. I just want to add before I take any comments that what I find so exciting about the era we're living in, partly because of the ease of sharing of information and travel and all sorts of things, but there are other reasons for it too, is the intersection and overlap between such radically different disciplines. So when science and mysticism start intersecting, when secular thought and philosophy and religious thought and philosophy start intersecting, when Eastern and Western start intersecting, then you know you're dealing with points of truth that are really important to be able to identify. Now some of you might be interested in the work that was done, and some of you probably know a lot more about it than I do. Rupert Sheldrake's experiments, are you familiar with Rupert Sheldrake? Mm-hmm. An interesting guy who's done scientific research, and a scientist from Oxford or Cambridge, did some work in the United States, and then I think still operates in the United States. He did some work, for example, with the creation of unstable crystals that couldn't possibly be created in nature. So he would create an unstable crystal form in his laboratory that had never been created before and doesn't exist, and then find similar formations in other parts of the world out there. What do you think about that? He would find, as part of the synchronicity theory, he found that you could train rats to do things that no rat had ever done, and you would find within months, rats in other parts of the world doing the same thing. That's not what's so surprising about that. There's a constant flow of energy back and forth, goes up all over the place. How often does it happen that somebody could invent something or discover something, and all of a sudden you find that within everybody else is onto it? Not because they heard it from the first guy, they didn't. But we heard it in the Torah too. The Shach will say something, and the Tav will say something, and we'll read the Nagi, they're printed alongside one another, and the Shach will say, I've just thought it was unbelievable idea. Nobody said it, and really reluctantly even said it, so revolutionary, and across the page, the Tav is saying exactly the same thing. It was 5 years later, or 2 years later, when I don't see the Shach. We have in the area of sexual information and knowledge as well. So the idea that there's a force, that there's something, that the God that is in me, and the God that is in you, and the God that is in every other cell and atom of life is Hashem Echad. One God is one force. Why is it so surprising? It's something I do should impact you. But something we do should impact something else. And why should distance have anything to do with it? We're talking about energy. We're not talking about physical transfer of objects. We're not talking about things that have to be delivered by FedEx or by UPS. We're talking about energy transfer. What difference should it make? Whether there's any kind of distance or not. That's something that's really important. This kind of work, by the way, wasn't even done by anybody as some might think is marginal as Rupert Sheldrake, but the EPR experiment, again, which I don't know, you probably know more about than I do. Einstein, Podolsky, and those, did the same work with subatomic particles, separating them with a wall that made it impossible for any physical, chemical, or electromagnetic communication. And then introduced a weird spin into the subatomic particle, which gets reciprocated immediately by the other subatomic particle, because they already made the transatomic thing. So scientists have really been onto this for decades, and more, trying to work out what is this force. That's where all the quantum stuff comes from, that there are forces of energy that don't abide by the physical laws of limitation that the rest of the world operates by. And to realize that when we're talking about spiritual stuff, we're talking in the quantum area, we're not talking in the mechanical area. We're used to thinking of the world mechanically, so we think, wow, how can that be? I do something here. In fact, then, I drive in here, and there can be an impact of that in the Shalayan tomorrow, or there can be an impact of that in Sydney, Australia tomorrow. How do we know that you can drive into somebody who's sick, and we do it all the time? And yet we get surprised when it works. There's no reason to get surprised when it works. It's nothing particularly spectacular. So when we talk about the majesty of the human being, and of the souls, clothed within souls, and our ability to communicate up to God's presence and back again, and the ability of all of us to bounce all over each other. These are things that we need to try and attune ourselves to. We need to try and feel. We need to try and access. What is it that we're doing when we're down? What is it when we're doing, when we're acting, when we're thinking, when we're feeling? All of these create energies that don't get lost. They're energies acting, they're energies doing things out there, they're energies that are actually achieving certain results. Which leads us into where I want to go today, which is, if we feel we've kind of accessed that intuition, let's say we've done this all properly, and we can all do nothing the whole week except working on what we did in during the time, we took the whole 10-week period, 12-week period off, and this is just what you're working on. And so, you've got that intuition right, you can now sort of look at some night and day with your eyes closed, you can feel it. And you've got that sense, you're in touch with your Jewishness, with your freedom, with your gender, with your masculinity or femininity. That procreative realm is there. You're busy understanding, seeing the world as it really is, with the error concept, seeing first and then absorbing intellectually afterwards. In touch with reality in an amazing way. And Malki Harun, you've now got the sense of clothing, so you've got the idea of the protection, you've got the private property and the public property, you're accessing the soul, you're connected with God, you've got the stand of soul, you understand the energy. Well, now we should get ready to move, we should go out and do that. But you might still find that you're somewhat stuck. I'm going to leave you one of the many knowing words for definitions of what it means to be stuck. Listen to it carefully, the definition is good. Stuck means to hold to or be held in something tightly or firmly, by or at least by being embedded or attached by adhesion. Again, either to hold to or to be held in. So there are two images. You can be stuck onto something you can't let go. Nothing's imprisoning you. There are no barriers. There's no cage. You just can't let go. That's called stuck. Or you might be held in something. You're in a box. You can't get up. Tightly or firmly, by or as if by, being embedded or attached by the adhesion. It's stuck to it, there's an adhesion, there's something that won't let you get let go, there's something that won't let you out. Taking that definition of stuck, I would like you to spend a few moments, you have spent some time beside us together, generating a few areas, this is not for sharing, this is just for you, that you're stuck in. That means a few areas where you should be somewhere else, doing something else, feeling something else, thinking something else. But a few areas in your life where you're just stuck. You're holding on to something, or you're stuck in something as if by adhesion. Don't go into why at this point or what's causing it. Just identify a few areas. The more the better. A few areas where you believe you should have moved, you should be doing something else or something different, but are not. Which means you suck. Try and generate a few of those for yourself. Spend a few minutes on it. It's very important. stuck in a job, stuck in a relationship, stuck in a situation, stuck in a habit, stuck in the absence of a habit that you should be in. Think of anything you might write down, you're stuck in an inability to identify anything you're stuck in.
Figuring out what you're not stuck in.
That would be a shorter list, you mean?
Sure.
Okay, if you've done that, move to phase two. I think you shake your head, that means you can't figure out anything you do stuck with you. That is really good.
I'm very happy to question.
As to whether they think there are any things, ideas, principles, dogmas that you discuss. Because what they perceive might be quite revealing and important. Because we're all stuck in stuff. So if we feel that we're not really stuck, we need to get a bit deeper. We need to get a little bit deeper, because one can get stuck in stuff to a point where you don't even realize you're stuck. I don't make up stuff. There's no point in making up stuff. And there might be very few areas that you're stuck in. But it's quite important to penetrate the areas that you might feel. And part of the real reason we sometimes don't feel we're stuck is because, you might hold an animal in a cage, and the animal was born in that cage, and to them that cage is their world. They don't need that stuck anyway. They're happy, they've got whatever they need in the cage. They can't imagine anything beyond the cage. So you need to check with yourself. Is the reason you're feeling okay with everything because you haven't thought beyond certain limitations in some areas? Or is it really genuine that you're just going to do an incredible person, you're not back anything, and get people to help you on that. It's really good to do that with somebody. Get a publisher in that area. It can be a wife, it can be a child, it can be a close friend, it can be a colleague, sometimes even a stranger. Because it's really important work to do, as you'll see from the next post. Because the next step I'm going to ask you to do is to go through that list and identify the causes of the stuckness. Just immediate gap. Don't get into a deep psychoanalysis there. Don't have time, nor is that going to give you the right answer. What's important is quick. What's causing the stuff? Who or what is causing you to be stuck? That's not the whole reason of why and why they should or why they shouldn't. What is the situation? What is the object? What is the person? What are the people? What is the expectation? What is it's keeping you stuck in the things you've identified? And just go down the list and identify the cause. And the last phase of that exercise is, can you see a common denominator of the things you're stuck in? Can you see a pattern? And if so, can you identify it? The things you're stuck in is any pattern that you can identify. That's the common denominator. Something that's common about all the areas in which you're feeling stuck. In a shiur before, a number of shiurs before, I've made reference to a book which I'm going to make reference to and quote some parts from again. And I'll explain to you why this one is not only is it so important. This, like in many other cases, this is a book called The War of Art. This is a book, The Art of War. It's not The Art of War, it's The War of Art. And like many books that are true, there's nothing in here that I couldn't find for you expressed at least as, well, probably even more succinctly and more deeply in Hazal. In the Gemara, in Moses' poem, there would be no problem of opposing here, I wouldn't know trying to be expressed in a more succinct and probably a deeper way. But what's interesting and valuable about these kinds of books are when people, through their own experience, go through a journey that reveals the things that you know are true just because somebody told you. Because what's important is that you go through the journey too. There are two ways we can relate to the Torah. The one is, it's a set of dogma given to us and which we accept because we believe in it. And that's fine, it's a level of belief, but we accept the Torah as it is. But that doesn't bring about personal transformation. That just brings about obedience, and when you get up those verses, that work, you do everything I told you to do, that's really nice. That is what you do, that's right. But that doesn't necessarily transform you to the point where you become a bigger person, a greater person, a better person. That comes from journey and truth. And sometimes it's interesting to read the struggles of people who journey through the very path that the Torah lays out. And this is the story of a man's struggle, contemporary writer, with the Yetzer Hara. And the ability to identify with the Yetzer Hara is easier here than in any of the Musa's books. Because this is something that, this is your and my life. This is something that applies to us every day. We're able to recognize it much more easily. Now, there are a few things that are quite important here that I want to check with you. Firstly, when you looked at the causes, some of you might have identified a number of causes external to yourselves. Other people, situations in which you find yourselves, resources. There might be all sorts of reasons outside of yourselves that are responsible for your being stuck in a situation. What's important to appreciate is that none of those resources would be causes to be stuck if getting out of that stuck was crucial. You would overcome them. If it's really important, if you've identified it as being stuck, then you say this is something you really want to do. But if we really want to do it, then we would find that we would find within ourselves the resources to overcome. So one of the important things to realize is that when you track through, and we don't have time to do this now, this is homework, and you look at those causes more deeply, you find the causes within self. And that's the Yetzer Hara. We'll talk about it in a little bit more depth in a moment. The second thing that might be important is the definition of the common denominator. And I'm going to share with you some of what he's written, and I encourage you to read it all when you have an opportunity. The author is a guy called Stephen Pressfield, who's written some other books too, apparently, and quite a well published author. But this is a little book that he wrote about writing. And not really about writing, it's really about life struggle. And his opening is the following. There's a secret that real writers know that one of you writers does. And the secret is this. It's not the writing part that's hard. The part of sitting down to write. What keeps us from sitting down is what he calls resistance. There is a force that stops you. We call that force the entire life. Call the force the ego, call the force gravity, call the force inertia, whatever you want. He goes into a lot of detail in analyzing what this force is and how it works. And his analysis from self-experience is aligned completely with the Muslim school's analysis of how the Yetzer Hara operates. So it keeps us from seeing down his resistance. A few more little quotes. This one I've used before in the show. Most of us have two lives, the life we live and the unlived life within us. Between the two stands resistance. Stand the Yetzer Hara. What's important here, part of the Kiddush here, is the Yetzer Hara is not the force that stops us doing what we want to do so that we do what we should do. The Yetzer Hara is the force that stops us doing what we want to do. What we truly want to do. And we get deep down into what we want to do. The things we stuck about. All things we want to do. The reason we're not is resistance. The Yetzer Hara, whatever we want to call it. That's the third. Here's his analysis of the common denominator. If you do the stack exercise, which he does in a slightly different way, but it doesn't matter. In other words, he says, it would be interesting for you to learn whether this applies to you. Any act that rejects immediate gratification in favor of long-term growth, health, or integrity are the things that we get stuck in. We don't get stuck on things that would generate immediate results. we get stuck on things, any act that rejects immediate gratification in favor of long-term growth, health, and integrity, or expressed another way, any act that derives from our higher nature instead of our lower, any of these will elicit resistance. If we're ego-driven, there's very little resistance. The things your ego wants or needs, you do. You find a way, you do it. The things that come from a higher self, that you're real, that you're deeper, when you get into soul stuff, that I really want to do in myself, those are the things we encounter resistance.
And the
any act that rejects immediate gratification in favor of long-term growth, health, and integrity. So when we're dealing with our higher purpose, that's when resistance gets in the way. When we're dealing with our immediate needs, no resistance. Sometimes there's the things we're going to manage, it's housekeeping stuff, but no major resistance. That leads into another conclusion. All of this you'll find in Chazal too. There's nothing that I'm reading to you that I can't attest to personally and that I haven't found in Chazal. Rule of thumb: the more important a call or action is to our soul's evolution, the more resistance we will feel towards pursuing. So he suggests using this as a barometer. When you find great resistance, you know you're onto something you ought to be doing. The most important it is for you to be doing, the more resistance you're going to have towards doing it. That's the nature of this. Now, he doesn't have a lot of discussion as to what. There's a lot of theological discussion as to the power of the earth. It's just a fact, this is how it is. And some suggestions about it coming. The last one. Resistance goal is not to wound or disable. Resistance aims to kill. Its target is the epic center of our being. Our genius, our soul, the unique and priceless gift we were put on earth to give, and that no one else has but us. Resistance means business, and we fight to do it in our walk to the death. What it wants doesn't mind you doing the ego stuff, it just minds you doing the stuff God put you there. That's what it was after you. So the last one, because it's just so useful, is procrastination is the most common manifestation of resistance. It is the easiest to rationalize. We don't say ourselves, I'm never going to write my symphony. Instead we say, I'm going to write my symphony. I'm just going to start tomorrow. That's it. That's that point. Ego says, I've got other stuff to do right now that has immediate gratification. The project that will yield results in the long term that I know is important to my soul, to who I really am, we'll do that tomorrow. When I'm fresh, when I'm ready to make things up, that will start tomorrow. That tomorrow is a denial of the power of the present moment to reverse the way we operate. The only space in which we can battle resistance is in that present moment. The only space we can battle resistance is in now. The moment you start thinking future or past, certainly future, with respect to resistance, we're into a battle that can't really be won. Now what's all this got to do with our awakening series? Let's explore in the awakening series whether there are any guidelines as to how to overcome resistance. Because in a sense, when is our resistance most absolute and most natural? During our day. When is it normal and natural to have resistance that is not overcome? When you sleep. When you sleep. And you see, you can't do anything. And that's normal and natural and okay. So the process of awakening has to include a process of overcoming resistance. So surely we can learn from the process that God gives us to awaken in the morning. A method of awakening, because resistance then means a sleepful state. If the overcoming of resistance is an awakeful state, if there are such words, then resistance is a sleepful state. We're in a mindless state. We're asleep to some degree or another. And what is the process? Let's look at how we do it, and let's figure out if there's an actual process that we can use. So the first thing we used, after we became intuitively aware that it's daytime, not in a way, kind of, dawn has broken, so we're kind of intuitively aware that it's daytime, and then we start tuning into who we are and who we're not, And then that important moment of prosperity is when we open our eyes and look at the world as it really is. That's when the awakening process, when the true awakening process starts. And how do we have to look at the world? At the world, what was the dynamic? You remember, iron resh. Awake means iron resh. First the eye, then the head. Look at the world the way it is, and then when you're sure you've got it the way it is, then integrate and analyze and make your judgments and do whatever you want to do with it. But don't start doing that before you perceive reality, otherwise you won't perceive reality, you'll only perceive what you already know. So the process of air is an ayin to reish process. Look with the eye, absorb with the senses. And here let's move a little bit beyond that, and let's consider using the eye, not only as a process of seeing, but as a process of vision. And here's why. They did a test. I'm going to give you all the scientific stuff that I can. When you start working on ideas, you get all sorts of support from all manner of places. They did an experiment on a group of rats, many groups of group of rats, I don't know why they always choose the rats, where they gave the rats cyclophosphamine and saccharine mixed together, which is an anti-cancer drug that diminishes or impairs the immune system. So you can imagine in the period after that the rats got sick. Their immune system was damaged and they became infected. That wasn't surprising to anybody. They then let the rats recover, which they did, took them off the medication, they recovered, they got strong, and no more infection. Then they gave them saccharine without cyclophosphamine. What did he have? Just saccharine. They got sick. What does that mean? Not only what that really means, one of the conclusions that we come up with is the capacity of the mind to impact the immune system. And what's important to me in that study is not the mind. So that's didn't go through an analysis and say, there's a whole lot of things and depress the thoughts about their future and start agonizing about existential questions and then they got infected. What was it to do? A sensation that they associated with the drug that caused them to become infected in the first place. So what's important here is the capacity to impact the mechanical, the physical body, which is what you need to do to get over the down bed anymore, which is the first process of overcoming resistance in the awakening process. Getting your body to do something uncomfortable. That's the resistance, that's what resistance is. If you get your body to have a piece of chocolate, or you love chocolate, that doesn't need a whole lot of character. It's quite easy to do that. The problem is to get your body to do something where gratification is going to be delayed. And in the meantime, it's just a nuisance, and they might even be painful. So if you take your body off to a massage, that's not so hard. To take your body off to a rigorous gym session or to go running, that's much more difficult. That's overcoming resistance. The process used in awakening, I'm going to suggest to you, is the process of visioning where you feel yourself in the awakened state. In other words, the gratification is delayed on your calculated time zone. But can you put your head into the space as if it were not relaxed? So in the case of, let's look at the getting up in the morning as the example of that. If you and you're lying in bed, you wake up in the morning on a day that you're going to go on a vacation that you've been waiting for ages, a magnificent vacation you need today. And nothing you have to do, you just bang your face, your hat, everything is done. All you have to do is go. How difficult is it to get up? Not such a problem. There's a level of excitement, enthusiasm, energy. Why? Because you're headed in the space of what you're going to be doing later, and what you're going to be doing later is fun. If we go into an early process and we can visualize pleasant sensations about the day, then the capacity to energize the body is bigger. And of course the shiur is not just about getting up in the morning, the shiur is about getting the body into action to do something discomforting because of something worthwhile down the road. So what I'm going to suggest is that the process of error we're going to take further than it was. It's not just about seeing the world before you start examining it. It's about feeling the world, sensing the world, vision in the world as it's going to be in terms of the positive things that the day is going to bring. So let's look at taking that a step further. How would we do that? One of the things we do in the night time is we say Hashkiveinu. Look at the first line of Hashkiveinu. Hashkiveinu Hashem Eloheinu L'shalom, the first prayer. God rest us, lay us down in rest, in peace. Hashkiveinu Hashem Eloheinu L'shalom. And then comes the next phrase, which is, V'ha'amidenu, L'chayim. And what does that mean? Ha'amidenu, and stand us up, make us upright again to L'chayim. For life.
Okay, the good translation.
Notice that it doesn't say what page of Ashkelon is.
34.
Say?
Bottom of 334.
And how does the English translate for David? And last down in peace, and then what?
Last down to sleep, Hashem, our God, in peace. Raise us to rest, our pain, to life.
Okay, good for you, a better translation. Raise us to life. It doesn't say raise us in life. It doesn't say make sure we're alive tomorrow morning. That's not what that seal is about. Then it would say, Baham, raise us to rest. Raise us alive. But that's not the peace. Yeah, raise us alive. That's what it says. It says Lechaim. Lechaim means for the purpose of life. Interesting that we say Lechaim in the drink, and we get reminded. That's the reason for it. Lechaim, that's the real time to say Lechaim. Lechaim Yibayim, Lechaim. Arouse us tomorrow morning for a purposeful, vital life. That's what we're asking for. Now let us say you said just that phrase before you went to sleep at night. After you said the Shema, you said that phrase before the Shema. You just said that phrase. Ve'na Hashem etenu l'shalom. You get a peaceful night. V'ha'amidenu ma'atenu l'chayim. And our King gives me to arise tomorrow morning to a purposeful life. And you pause it. And you go into meditation. Relax, fill your mind, and think, what about tomorrow is going to be your purpose? Because there's no point in asking God for something you've made no preparation for. What do you mean by that? What do you want to be purposeful? What is your purpose? Imagine you were really having a conversation with God. And you said, when God said, just before you went to sleep, what did you wish? And you would say, God, a peaceful night and wake me up for a purposeful existence tomorrow morning. What would God want? Sure, no problem. What is your purpose? What is it? What do you mean by purposeful? What is hiding to you? What do you mean by that? What is vitality? Does it mean playing sports? Does it mean going for a swim? Does it mean saving your life? What is time for you? What is a vital existence? What do you mean by a vital existence? The fact is, most of us, what we mean by a vital existence is exactly what God gives us the next day, which is a dull and dreary repetition of the day before, what the next day happens. Because that's what we mean by vital in our minds. We haven't gone any further than that. We assume what we did today is what life is about. So if you give me another day off today, we're kind of saying to God, that will be okay. No, we should thank God, that won't be okay. I don't want another day off today. Today is finished. I want something more vital than today. Fine, what do you mean by life? And I feel this. And figure out, what do you mean by life? Quite an interesting answer. What does it mean to you? And to give you a little bit of guidance in that process, break it up into four areas. What does it mean by vital in terms of your purpose? What kind of purpose do you want to be living tomorrow? What is the purpose of your existence tomorrow? And that has to move into your purpose of your existence for the rest of your life. At all times, you should have a sense of your purpose. Why is God made? What are you here for? You might evolve that purpose through your lifetime. It might change. It might develop. As you change, your circumstances change. Your insights and understanding change. It doesn't matter. But at any time, you should have a sense of why you're doing, why you're alive. What's your purpose? Why did God make you? You're unique, you're different, you're talented, you're energetic, you've got life experiences, you see the world in a particular way. What are you meant to do with all that stuff? You need to have something in mind. And then what is tomorrow going to do with it? In what way does tomorrow the kind, but the kind that I want tomorrow, in what way will that contribute? The second is just vitality, life vitality. What do you mean by that? How do you want to feel? And when you're doing this exercise, don't do it mentally, do it visually. A, don't use your head first and then your eyes. Use your eyes, but your imaginary eyes. Visualize what it means to be living with a purpose tomorrow. Visualize what that means, with a purpose that really satisfies you. That satisfies you in a deep soul way. That makes you feel, this is what I would live with that in mind. So you get trying to get as deep as you can in the sense of purpose. Vitality is, what do you feel like when you're back? Feel it. Feel what it's like for. When last you felt like. Might have been today, it might have been last week, it might have been when you were on vacation, 6 months ago. Just try and remember when you last felt really vital. When was that? And recover that sense of vitality. God, that's what I mean. When I say Rechaim, that's the vitality I want to feel tomorrow. And then at a sensual level, I want to have some nice experiences. I want to feel some good things. What am I going to do tomorrow? Am I going to eat something delicious? Am I going to go for a walk in a beautiful park? Am I going to stand by the ocean? Am I going to go for a swim? What am I going to do that is going to give me a sensation that is nourishing, that is pleasant, that feels alive? And the fourth one is relationship. What interaction am I going to have with another human being tomorrow that is going to be vital, meaningful, impactful, deep, satisfying? Now why I choose those four areas is because those four areas deal with the four key levels of our existence. I said we span a huge space from the energy just above our feet down to our own body. But if we look at the four lower levels of that, if we just look at the origins of all of that, there are four of them. The body is the good. And the good has to feel alive. When does the good feel alive? When does the body feel alive? And that's essential experience. You use one of your five senses in order to feel alive. So you've got to identify, what do I mean? God, let me have Lechaim tomorrow. What kind of sensual experience do you intend to have sometime during tomorrow, if not the whole day, sometime, that you'll be in touch with feeling physically alive? The next is the nefesh, which is the life force, the vitality, the sense of energy. What do you mean by giving Lechaim tomorrow? What energy do I want to feel? And then ruach is relationship, the spirituality of the person in relationship. Our interact with the common spiritual sources that we all have. And our sense of purpose, that's linking up with God. That's within our soul. Why am I here? What's the deepest reason for my being, for my existence? If we could spend some time the night before clarifying that. And I say, that's what I mean, God. I want to feel vital in all four areas of my existence. I want my body to feel vital. I want my energy to feel vital. I want my relationship to feel vital. I want to feel vital in relationship with people. And I want to feel vital spiritually, a sense of purpose and soul and connection to God and the bigger picture of things. That's what I want to do. And you store that in your mind as you go to sleep. With a pleasure. I should all be pleasant. Just want to get you all anxious. This should all be beautiful visions of things you want to do tomorrow, even if they're a little bit green. As long as it's not completely unrealistic. Just four nice areas of really pleasant things. You don't speak with that. And when you wake up in the morning and you've gone through the kind of opening your eyes, and now you recapture what you had last night. That's what my day is going to be today. This is what I'm going to be doing. All the other stuff I have to do, these are all qualitative experiences I'm going to have today. I'm going to nourish my sense of purpose. I'm going to nourish my relationship, the relationships, the one of my relationships. I'm going to nourish my energy. And I'm going to nourish my senses. I'm going to do all of that today. Why wouldn't one get out of bed? Why are you lying in bed? Wouldn't one say, well, let's do that right now. Let's stop. Let's get going. Let's do that right now. For half an hour, I don't have anything to show you. I could use essential stuff now. I could have a nice bath now. I could go for a run. Do that right now. What's following it up. Or I could do the spiritual stuff right now, because I'm done. Align my thinking, my spirit, get all along with that. I could do that right now. I could start that process. If the waking up process is with the eye of visualizing, with the eye of visualizing, rather than with the head of analyzing, the head, if you wake up with your head, what do you wake up with? Orange. That's how you wake up, if you wake up in your head. But if you wake up in your senses, what's orange? What are you like? That's what you asked God for. I can't do it. Much easier to get better. And that's a process we can use throughout the day. If you need to get going, visualize the fulfillment of what you need to do down the line. That you're there, I'm here for you. What does it feel like to be there? What does it feel, what does the process feel like? What does it feel like to be there? So if I have to get myself to the gym, and that's not a pleasant process, the only way I can do it with energy is to capture in my being, in my imagination, what it feels like when I'm finished. Then there's a chance I'll move with energy. And so is with every process we go through. Whether it goes to gardening, I'm not necessarily that one, but what does it feel like when I'm sitting with my feeling in a state of mind which is peaceful? What does it feel like? When your feeling is there, maybe the mice, they overcome, just as they impair their immune system, by the feeling that they had when they took that drug. So we can do it the other way around. We can uplift the immune system or introduce any other form of bodily energy by encapsulating an image, a feeling. That's what air means. Use your iron and then your rosh. Don't start with your head because you'll analyze your opportunity to death and you won't do it. That's where procrastination comes. Many reasons why don't do it. But you don't procrastinate with the right. And if you can create within yourself an alive image of what it is like to be there already, then we can begin the process. And what book is this that we say? After Mahavishalam, yeah, we're going to look at Mahavishalam to do this, I'm going to be in touch with who I really am. I'm going to be in touch with my private property. To do this, I'm going to know that I won't make an idiot of myself, because I've got private problems. People don't even know what's going on inside me. They don't know what my purpose is, they don't know what my vitality is. That's all internal. It will glow to the outside world, but it happens deep inside me. So my Vishalim is really important. And what's the next one? Matira Surim. Releases the stuff. Now these brachot are not brachot to God. God, release the stuff. It's not a prayer. A brachot is not a prayer. What a brachot means, thank God for giving me the talent and energy and skill and knowledge to be myself. When you say, I'm not selecting higher, what does that mean? Thank God for putting a loaf of bread on my table. I don't know where it came from. But I baked it. Or I bought it. And somebody planted the wheat and milled it, baked it, delivered it. There was huge human energy in it. What are you thanking God for? For giving us the capacity to do that. For making a profit. So when we say Matira Surim, we don't mean thank you God for unbinding the sack. What we mean is thank you God for teaching us how to unbind ourselves and stop feeling sick. For giving us that skill. Now where you see this in the world, so interesting is, one would think, if we stuck because of inertia, then unbinding won't be enough. If something's suffering from inertia, and you remove the tart, does it stop moving? No. So you see from Matsura Surin that this is not about inertia. Even principle is not altogether right in it. It's not about inertia. Our bodies maybe have inertia. But there's a huge burning energy and passion. All we have to do is release the inhibitor, and then it moves. The inhibitor is that analysis, the only what I have to do, duty, the obligation. Simply put yourself in the feeling of being there, so that that becomes the future. You bring the future into the present. And that's what we do. This is what us Jews do the blackest of times. What did the Jews say when they walked to the gas chambers? No. Ani the what?
The
Biyat HaMashiach. Were they out of their minds? Walking to the gas chambers in those years, I believe, singing in the coming of the Mashiach? or is it simply putting themselves in a future position and feeling what it is like to be there, even as they walk through their day? Human beings have that capacity. We can vision, we can imagine, we can put ourselves in place. We can take the future and we can bring it into the present. So the present doesn't have to be limited to what we're feeling just by the things that we're actually in physical contact with. We can enhance the experience of the present by bringing some of the future into it. And that's the messianic idea, that's how we live with the messianic idea in the future. But it's something we should do every single morning, something we should do every night, it's something we should do every day. When we're encountering resistance, is to be able to be materially absolute. You don't have to energize the body, just remove the inhibitor. The inhibitor is Ra. Raish first, then I. Switch it around, and the inhibition is moved. I am first. Look into the future, look into your purpose, look into your vitality, look into your energy, look into your sensual nourishment, look into your relationship nourishment, and find that pleasure, and feel that pleasure. And then you won't have to say to yourself, should I get up now, or should I still sleep a little longer? That won't be in the lens, won't be an issue. Matthew, absolutely. The ties will be unbound, and you'll feel a freedom to be able to get going, to be able to do stuff, to be able to get the day in the week. Energize with that. That's the power of Matsyura Suya. And that's the power that we're able to use, not only at the time of awakening, but as we awaken ourselves from a mindlessness during the day. Whether we catch ourselves in that, something we can do very quickly, and we can do so, we can do those four exercises very quickly. Feel inside you what it's like, energy, and do it.